I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, we'll have a Friday conversation with author Maurice Sendak about the dark forces behind his beautiful books. But first, the governor of Iowa has declared 83 of that state's 99 counties disaster areas. Nine rivers are at or above historic flood levels. Dozens of bridges have been destroyed. And with both the Missouri and Mississippi rivers still rising, communities are bracing for the worst. Millions of acres of corn have been flooded, which will send food prices even higher, and Amtrak has suspended its California Zephyr line across Iowa because of flooded tracks. In Cedar Rapids, water to the top of stop signs has inundated 100 city blocks and forced the evacuation of a hospital. Josh Hinkle is with KCRG-TV9, the ABC affiliate in Cedar Rapids. Josh, tell us, what is happening there?
Well, Cedar Rapids is kind of unique because it has an island right in the middle of the river where all of our governmental buildings are, the jail, everything like that. All of those things had to be evacuated, including the jail. So all the prisoners have been taken to an undisclosed location for security purposes because that entire island is underwater. The river runs directly through the middle of town. It kind of splits Cedar Rapids, so people on both sides are getting about the same amount. And the downtown is kind of the heart of the town.
Right.
And that's where all the shops and all the, big businesses are, and no one can go to work, and now people that are living close to downtown are worrying as well. Yesterday morning, we actually went downtown, and as we were getting there, we saw a boat was pulling out, and they said they had to go rescue 16 people that were trapped in Alliant Tower, which is our city's tallest building. The people had actually gone into Alliant Tower to grab some necessary work supplies. They thought they had enough time to get out, but they didn't, and by the time they were done gathering those supplies, the water was 7 feet higher than it was, well over their doorway, so they had to call someone in to rescue them.
Well, with so much water everywhere, we understand a big problem is a shortage of clean water.
Yes, a lot of the places are without water today, and even places that do have water have been ordered to, conserve your water, only use it for drinking. Don't use it for bathing or washing dishes or washing clothes or anything like that. Only your essential needs.
Yeah, because, of course, when there's rising waters like this, things like sewage and other toxins spill into the clean water.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and not just water, but basic services like electricity. We understand one of the reasons that the hospital there was evacuated is that the generator was on the first floor. How much of a problem is the electricity?
Well, that hospital you're talking about, Mercy Hospital, is very close to downtown. Downtown doesn't have electricity at all. A lot of Cedar Rapids doesn't have electricity, and they're saying it could be more than a week before it's actually restored after the floodwaters recede enough for power plant workers to actually get to those lines.
Well, and what is the thinking about whether or not the water is going to recede? We understand the highest it's ever been was back in 93 when it was at a little over 19 feet, and it's expected to crest today at 31 feet. So what is the thinking about, when it might recede?
Well, they're hoping it starts this weekend, but, we've got a line of thunderstorms that we're looking at this weekend, according to our meteorologists. And so people just wonder if it continues to rain, which it has been throughout this week, will the water keep going up? And that's just something we don't know about yet.
Mm. This is being called the 500-year flood where you are. Well, what are people saying to you? Because we talked to you several days ago, and you said, the sandbags are going to hold, this water's not going to crest over, the riverbanks, and here you are, flooded. And it's happened in other cities as well. Where people said, no, this can't happen here. So what are people saying now that it has?
Well, people are upset, but they're being very courteous. I mean, they understand that the city and the county are doing everything they can, and I haven't really gotten a sense of that this is someone's fault or anything like that. People are just scared and trying to deal with their own personal lives because this has affected so many people. I mean, anywhere between 9,000 and 10,000 people right here in Cedar Rapids, I mean, they've had to get out, and that's just a terrible thing for each individual and each family.
Josh Hinkle, a reporter and anchor for KCRG-TV9, the ABC affiliate in Cedar Rapids. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak is often called the Picasso of children's books. You probably have a favorite of the 108 he's written and illustrated over his 60-year career. There's Chicken Soup with Rice, about a boy who sings a rhyming song for every month of the year. There's In the Night Kitchen, another boy falls out of bed and into cake batter in a fantastical kitchen run by three doughy Oliver Hardy look-alike bakers. And, of course, there's the award-winning classic, Where the Wild Things Are, about the night little Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind, turn the page, and another.
His mother called him Wild Thing! And Max said, I'll eat you up! So he was sent to bed without eating anything. That very night, in Max's room, a forest grew. And grew. And grew.
Maurice Sendak turned 80 on Tuesday, and the largest exhibition of his work is now open at the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia. So today, a conversation with Maurice Sendak from his home in Connecticut. Welcome, Mr. Sendak.
Thank you.
I have to say, we love your answer machine. It says, if you're in a hurry, go away.
Yes, because everyone, mostly when they're calling from New York, toe-tapping with impatience. So I give them plenty of warning to go away if they don't have anything important to say. Just scram, because I'm not going to run.
No, because at 80, why should you?
Exactly. But you'd be amazed at how many people don't call anymore.
I think it's because they can't believe that they'd get to talk to you. I already promised I'm not going to be unctuous, but it's quite a pleasure, and happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
Your thoughts on turning 80?
It is the strangest feeling that I could have leaped to 80. It just was too fast.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that happen along the way. Let's stay a little with Where the Wild Things Are. The little boy Max we met, the forest grows in his room, he sails a boat, meets the wild things, who, by the way, don't look very wild to me, tames them with a trick of looking into their yellow eyes. Where did that come from?
Well, that comes from our relatives. All the wild things are relatives who were brought over by my parents during World War II when they were trying to get Jewish people out of Europe. And these are the ones in my mother's family, because that's what my father thought appropriate. And he got most of her siblings out and her mother, but that was it. And when he turned to his own family, they were gone.
Oh. Well, how much of the storytelling is about that, you know, about taming the monsters by looking in their eyes?
Well, yes, I have never claimed to be a writer of children's books. I wrote honestly. I wrote about my life. I wrote about what was happening. There were many bleak, dark moments. I wanted to be very, very honest. I also knew that the worst thing you could do to children is lie. And not appreciate the fact that the truth, no matter how painful, is more acceptable to them than some nonsense story. And I've gotten in trouble over that in terms of some of the books I did. Some people thought the wild things were too frightening. I've tried not to care about that because, as I said, I didn't set myself out to write books for children or to make life easier or charming or funny. If it is, it is. And sometimes it is funny. But I'm a writer and an illustrator, and I take my work seriously.
Should we look for these references and other stories? For instance, you know, I'm thinking of Mickey, the little boy in the night kitchen, a personal favorite, falls out of bed, as we said, past his mom, into the cake batter in the night kitchen. But I can't help but notice now that he narrowly escapes the oven. You know, he was going to be baked.
And you got it.
Oh, really?
You got it. And did you notice the bakers have little Hitler mustachios?
I do now.
Yep.
Yeah. And he makes his way out by making a plane out of bread dough. Now that breaks my heart.
No? Well, don't let it break your heart. Continue to enjoy the book, but I think it thickens and makes more profound, if I dare use that word, the work in hand, that it comes from those sources. I grew up during all of that. I was born just at the beginning of it, and I had to see what sufferings my parents went through. It was not to be believed.
Yeah. Your biographer, the playwright Tony Kushner, talks about that, and I want to hear, you know, what he has to say about your writing. But speaking of Tony Kushner, now it can be told. If anyone's seen Angels in America, there is that scene with three rabbis, and it's
right.
Tony Kushner, Meryl Streep, and you.
It is me, indeed.
Let's remind ourselves, a young gay man whose partner has AIDS asks the rabbi, played by Meryl Streep, what the Holy Writ has to say about someone who leaves a loved one at a time of great need. Here is the response from Meryl Streep as a rabbi in the film.
The Holy Scripture has nothing to say about such a person.
Rabbi, I'm afraid of the crimes I may commit.
Please, mister, I'm a sick old rabbi facing a long ride home to the Bronx. You want to confess, better you should find a priest.
What was that like?
Oh, it was hilarious because, of course, I had no idea it was her. I thought it was a man. And I mean, it was testing out. They wanted to see, could she really be the one to do this? And, of course, she was remarkably successful, if detestable. And I was ready to just punch her out, or rather punch him out, because I thought it was a man.
And even if it was a rabbi, you were gonna.
I'm always ready.
Well, anyway, there the three of you are in that scene. It's just delightful. But Tony Kushner, you've collaborated with him on Brundibar,
yes.
The children's book and opera about two kids who overcome an organ grinder bully, More Shades of Hitler.
Right.
Well, he writes that you suffer a book. Rather than write one, you suffer a book.
I think under pressure he would have to admit that he suffers a play.
Yeah, but yours are supposed to be children's books, but you've revealed to us what you know, part of what you're bringing to the table. And we understand, you know, so hard at times that you actually suffered a nervous breakdown doing Outside Over There.
Correct.
Why? What was...
I don't know. The book was of an extremely personal nature. My sister was in it. Mozart was in it. Important people in my life were in that book. And it brought me low. It brought me low because it probably touched on very deep unconscious things that the artist, of course, is always struggling to bring up.
Yeah.
And put down on paper and solve and win. And that book was probably the hardest book I ever pulled out of myself.
Maurice Sendak, that's speaking now about his dark 1981 fairy tale, Outside Over There, in which a baby gets kidnapped by goblins. When we come back, how his family history might have informed that writing and why it was so hard for him. Later, a report for prospective parents on cutbacks in childbirth lead. You want to hear that as well. Back in a minute here and now. We're back with more from Maurice Sendak, writer and illustrator of children's classics like Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. He turned 80 on Tuesday, and the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia has opened a major retrospective of his work. We've been hearing, and frankly are surprised to hear, how much of Sendak's writing is informed by the fact that much of his family on his father's side perished in the Holocaust. We were talking about his 1981 fairy tale, Outside Over There. He suffered a nervous breakdown writing it. It's laid out like a children's storybook with beautiful illustrations, but it tells of an infant who gets kidnapped by goblins and how big sister Ida must go find the baby outside over there. And Maurice Sendak, I'm thinking of how your mother was able to save her siblings from outside over there, but your father couldn't.
Yeah. See, that was always an immensely fascinating place for me because that's where they came from. They did get my grandmother. The only grandparent I have is my mother's mother. And the stories she told were so frightening, were so chilling. Jewish people in tiny villages where nobody wanted them. And so they were not the cheerful stories. I didn't grow up on Robin Hood. I didn't grow up on Oz. So to be sad and quiet, I'm afraid, was what childhood was like.
Well, and then you add to that, you say it was in part inspired by the 1932 Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which probably terrified a lot of children.
Oh, well, correct. I mean, that was just about the worst that could happen. And so there was no way that childhood could be some Winnie the Pooh nonsense.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be fortunate enough to be Christopher Robin. Fate put me where it put me, and it put a lot of kids in much worse conditions than I was in. But it leaves this big, fat handprint on you.
Yeah. Well, we rush to say, too, that if you don't read it with that backstory, I mean, even if you do, I mean, we have so much fun in the night kitchen, you know, making dough into an airplane and falling in a milk bottle.
Well, you see, it is, it's a funny idea. I loved it. I thought it was such a funny idea. And it made me remember my mother, who made marvelous cookies, and they came out all different shapes. That the other things creep in is something I can't prevent.
And when I see Where the Wild Things Are today, I see Shrek. I see, what was that, Monsters,
yes,
Inc., where the little,
yes,
boy goes through the wall? I see all of those monsters that aren't really monsters.
Well, I think I can say this honestly without sounding vain. You wouldn't have seen them pre-Wild Things.
Yeah.
Wild Things did break the wall. It did come out and say there were such things as nightmares and creatures that children had to contend with, that adults have to contend with. And yet, I don't want to make light of that fear, because how could we not be fearful for our children? So even if sometimes, you know, I get annoyed that somebody thinks something of mine is too frightening for their kid, well, then I always just tell them, don't read it. Because some things are, and there are some who just will be frightened at anything. Often they change those conclusions later. It's nice. In the old days when I would be at college and some person would shake my hand firmly and say, boy, that book really scared me as a kid, but I just love it now. And that's great. That's what art is. We learn. We learn.
Let me ask you about the illustrations, because we're reading a book right now, Leonard Marcus's new book about children's literature called Minders of Make-Believe.
Yeah.
Yep. He says, you're the inheritor of the romantic visionary tradition that goes back to William Blake in the, you know, 19th century. And others have said, oh, my gosh, it's modern artist Rousseau and Picasso and Joseph Cornell and Andy Warhol and Mickey Mouse.
I get a joy for William Blake. But I also get a joy, which is probably the greatest joy I had as a child, was Mickey Mouse. And the sight of him on the screen, and I remember my sister telling me this, she said, because there was always a double feature, and in the middle was a Mickey Mouse cartoon. And she says, when we got to the cartoon, I practically had to sit on you because you went berserk. And I think just the colors on his body, the fun of it all. There was very little to be happy about back then, and Mickey was it. Mickey was the clown that never failed to make me laugh, and physically was so beautiful because graphically he was so well done, and the colors chosen for him were so yummy. In every way, he was superb.
And he was also scary. Remember Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Oh, well, yeah.
The brooms multiplying and the water coming and he couldn't,
yes,
get rid of it?
No, he wasn't the coward.
Yeah, yeah. He was heroic.
And that's probably why he won over so many children who would have been afraid to have gone through some of those.
Is that part of, you know, do you want your kids to, you know, be heroic?
Yes.
Win?
You want them to be honest. Yeah. I don't do books specifically for children to teach them anything. So if you can translate that, then it could only mean I just don't want to lie to them. Mm. Even if it verges on the scary, even if it verges on subject matter, which there are parents and librarians who will say, not appropriate. Mm.
Well, they obviously haven't noticed your descendants, including Harry Potter.
That's true. Now look at all the troubles that he gets into. But you see, I have been around for so long, and I've been the beating up boy for scary books. So that now, of course, you can get away with so many things. But I'm not going to worry about that. I'm not going to worry about that because I'm just turning this ridiculous age. I want to live as long as I can. I want to produce important books.
Maurice Sendak, one last question. Do you look under the bed at night?
No.
No.
Well, sometimes I do because I live in the country and I do for ticks.
Actually, ticks can be dangerous. Maurice Sendak turns 80 this month. The Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia has opened a major exhibit of his artwork. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Me too. Well, still ahead today, people here on the East Coast still don't know the Celtics won that game last night. We'll have more after the news here and now. In Washington, the House approved an extra 3 months of jobless benefits for unemployed Americans this week after the Labor Department reported that the number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits increased by tens of thousands last week. The Senate still needs to take the measure up, and the president has threatened a veto, and cutbacks on benefits are the trend. A new report finds that employers are cutting back maternity and paternity leave, and that only 16% of employers offer fully paid leave for parents, down from 30% 10 years ago. Well, Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger wrote about the report's findings. She joins us. Sue, why are we starting to see employers cut these benefits?
Employers aren't targeting new moms here. What's happening is a broad overall cut in disability pay costs. More employers are paying less than 100% for disability leave in order to encourage people to get back to work when they're well. And this, because of the way maternity leave is structured in the U.S., hits new moms, too, because we classify maternity leave as disability leave.
And for many moms, it is. I mean, it takes weeks to recover from giving birth. But it's down to 16% of the 1,100 companies surveyed. That's not a lot, offering fully paid leave, from 27% just 10 years ago.
That's right. We're seeing more employers offer partial pay for leave, which can make a big difference for a new mother struggling to cover costs. And it does cause mothers to rush back to work a little sooner. And this really speeds the trend we've already been seeing for a couple of decades in the U.S. toward shrinkage in the time that mothers are taking off after childbirth.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what is going on here. You alluded to, you know, companies across the board cutting back on their disability benefits. 10 years ago, you know, economy was pretty sound, low unemployment, near zero inflation, a federal surplus. So is it directly tied to reaction to the economy?
Well, it certainly is related. And we were seeing a real economic boom in the late 90s, which is the comparison period in this study. And now we're seeing employers trying to cut costs as closely as they can and to manage absence. They don't want people to be out of work unnecessarily. These moves are really targeted more at that employee who may have, what, a broken arm and feel like taking an extra week off when actually they could get back to work if they had a little more incentive to do so. However, moms are caught in the crossfire, and that's, again, because of the way we categorize parental leave in the U.S. Most states, all but three, lack any paid parental leave policy, which gives pay simply for being a new parent. That's why we're seeing this cutback.
Well, yeah, because it's affecting paternity leave as well, which, you know, we have colleagues are saying, what? There's paternity leave? Because, you know, they're not offered it. But that's also dropped. So what does paternity leave fall under?
Well, paternity leave is an employer policy generally or federally mandated by the Family and Medical Leave Act or state family leave laws. These leaves are almost invariably unpaid, but more employers are offering dads at least 1 or 2 weeks off after childbirth to be home and bond with that baby. And a few of them are offering even more.
At least in the company surveyed, they were offering 13.1 weeks for dads, and it fell to 12.6 weeks for those who were offering, you know, fuller leave. By the way, who did the survey?
This was from the Families and Work Institute, a very respected nonprofit organization in New York, and the reason the survey is worth focusing on is it's really the only nationally representative employer survey that really reflects mainstream employers nationwide.
So they did the survey of 1,100 employers. But what else did you find in poking around with the issues of paternity and maternity leave?
Well, some employers are bucking this trend. The employers that are really consciously paying attention to what their employees want, Bank of America, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deutsche Bank, Phoenix Companies, Pfizer, are among the firms that have actually expanded maternity and paternity leave in the past couple of years. And these are employers who are consciously looking at what employees want and what parents need and separating out parental leave policies for that reason.
And employers usually do things because they're better, you know, for the bottom line, ultimately. You know, what are people finding about women and perhaps men rushing back too soon from these leaves?
Well, the research has documented very clearly that when mothers are compelled to return to work too soon, it increases the risk of postpartum depression in many moms. Also, many parents feel, especially keenly now, the need to be with babies as long as possible in the first year, because we have a whole body of research in the last decade showing how plastic the infant brain is during that first year developmentally. So when employers take the time to ask employees what they want, Bank of America did this a couple of years ago, surveyed 100,000 employees and found that better maternity benefits was one of their biggest concerns.
Well, and what should new parents do if they don't have the longer maternity leaves? What would you recommend that they do to prepare?
It's never been more important to plan ahead. I think before even getting pregnant, it's wise for new parents to start saving. Start living as though you've already had the baby, as though you already have hundreds of dollars in child care expenses every month, and bank that money. Take a regular payroll deduction if need be, or deduction from your checking account to savings, so that you can finance extended time off for yourself. And negotiate with your employer. Many employers do talk one by one with employees about their needs, and many times they will negotiate agreements with individual employees to extend leaves longer or arrange for phased return. It's a time to really plan, research, and discuss with your manager the best options for you.
The other thing you notice that what parents are doing now is making sure that they bank their sick days and vacation days ahead of time so that they can also use those.
Yes, most employers will allow you to bank at least a little bit of sick or vacation time, and many of the parents I spoke to did this to good advantage and got an extra month or two of leave. Unfortunately, the trend in this area is against this, too. More employers are requiring employees to use their vacation because they want them to take the R&R.
But one thing you say financial planners say don't do is use your credit card.
It's not wise to take on debt. Some parents, in the emotion of the moment, will pile on credit card debt or run up a home equity credit line or even withdraw money from your 401k or your IRA. These are not sound moves. Once you become a parent, you're going to need long-term saving more than ever. Even if you have to arrange to cut your expenses sharply, better not to take on debt to finance a parental leave.
And Sue, I know your column in the Wall Street Journal is called Work and Family, but I'm wondering, what do new parents do when they come up against resentful fellow employees who say, why should you get time off? I've had an ailing parent or needed mental health time and I don't have that. What do you do when they come up against that resentment?
On an individual level, I think an employee is obligated to coworkers as well as supervisors to try to carry your load and arrange fairly that your work is going to be covered. On an organizational level, I don't see employers singling out parents for special treatment. What I see is employers that bother to think about what parents need are also thinking about what elder caregivers need and what overworked employees need to restore and recharge their batteries. So I don't see that backlash happening as much anymore, as employers are understanding that treating parents well is just part and parcel of treating all employees like human beings with lives outside work.
That's Sue Shellenbarger. She writes the Work and Family column for the Wall Street Journal. Sue, thanks for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Robin.
And by the way, on Monday we'll ask, should adoptions be colorblind, or should white parents in particular be counseled before they adopt multiracial children? That's Monday. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's let's take a minute for your thoughts, and there were many, that we were happy to forward to Kevin Lucey. He's the father who's suing the Veterans Administration, saying they didn't do enough to help his son, an Iraq War veteran who took his life after suffering severe post-traumatic stress. E. Freeman writes, "My dad was a POW of the Japanese during World War II. It would be another 50 years before the VA diagnosed him with PTSD. In between, we lived with a father who was explosive. We tiptoed around him. His screaming nightmares lasted his whole life." Kevin Lucey said that his family became victims of his son's PTSD. How well I know it. My heart goes out to the Lucey family, and maybe through their terrible loss and now lawsuit, other families will be helped and not suffer as his and mine did. Katie Good wrote after our piece yesterday on how employers might improve the workplace for people with Asperger's, a highly functioning form of autism, people who have trouble with socializing or stimulus like fluorescent lighting. Finally, Katie writes, someone's talking about my problem. As you can imagine, someone with social interaction problems tends not to make a good PR person, so being able to have my boss listen to a radio story makes explaining my issues so much easier. I'm an engineer, and I'm very lucky since my boss is willing to work with me on things like lighting and changing my computer screen, so thank you. It's very hard for us to speak up for ourselves, and with more reports like yours, we can take in a radio clip and say, see, this is me. What can we do? And finally, the most controversial topic of the week, Coldplay. Let's go out and I can be seen. The tides that I tried to swim against put me down upon my knees. Barbara Shea of Phoenix agrees with our reviewer Renee Graham that Coldplay is boring, but Monica Dove of Nashville, New Hampshire writes, those Coldplay crescendos, that's real passion. And since I agree with her, she gets the last word. Send us your thoughts at here-now.org. That's HERE-NOW.org. But wait, no, Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game gets the last word. What do you think of Coldplay?
Stepping over the line. Yeah, they rock, no question.
Okay, more important, how about those Celts? A quick check of sports with Bill. We're in Boston, but even in Los Angeles, they're marveling at how the Boston Celtics overcame a 24-point deficit to beat the L.A. Lakers last night in L.A., take game four of the NBA championship. The series now 3-1 Celts. Has anyone ever come back from that deficit?
Not from 24 points in the finals. So the answer to your question is no, nobody has. And the only way the Lakers will be able to say nobody has done what we have done is if they win three games in a row and come
and
back from a 3-1 deficit in the finals.
What happened? I mean, people in the East, the morning newspapers had it wrong. You know, they had the Celts losing. The deficit was so big.
The early edition.
They're
right.
Classics now. You know, Dewey beats Truman. But what happened? Was it that the Lakers folded or the Celts, you know,
well, this is the eternal debate in a situation like this. Was the defense so good that the Lakers stopped scoring, or was the offense, the Celtics offense, so good that the Lakers couldn't stop it? So the truth is somewhere in between. But I have to acknowledge that, and I am, after all, a professional, to quote Hunter Thompson, I have to acknowledge that I was utterly floored by what happened.
Yeah.
I watched the comeback as it was developing, and I kept saying, oh, yeah, sure, lots of teams come back, and they almost make it, and then they run out of gas, and they lose the game. You know, more power to the Celtics for what they managed to do last night.
There's a shadow over well, for the Lakers now, big shadow, but for, overall, there's a shadow because of the kerfuffle over the former NBA ref, Tim Donaghy, who was convicted of fixing games in a gambling scheme. Without naming names, this week he said other refs rigged outcome of playoff games in 2002 and 2005. David Stern, the head of the NBA, had to hold a press conference last night. How much is that impacting
well,
this?
Well, first of all, it is a shame that this is coming out at the time that it is, because people, they have a chance to watch this magnificent series, at least if you're a Boston fan, it's magnificent. It's very hard for me to believe that the league actually directed officials to achieve one outcome rather than another. On the other hand, the last thing any league needs is even the perception of improper conduct by the officials.
No, well, Stern says no, no, 1,000 times no. It hasn't happened. Bill Littlefield, host of National Public Radio's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Next game, Celtics-Lakers, Sunday, Father's Day. Will you be watching?
Yeah, it should be easy after last night, right? It should be a can of corn. I don't know if the Lakers will show up.
Back in a minute, here and now. Singer-songwriter Ellis Paul has roots in Maine's potato country and here in Boston, and fans of his folk sound across the country. His music has added to the soundtrack for the TV shows Ed and The Real World, as well as films by the Farrelly brothers, Shallow Hal, and Me, Myself, and Irene featured The World Ain't Slowin' Down. But in addition to being a folkie, Ellis Paul is also a father. His new CD is for a younger audience.
I bought a ticket to the dragonfly races, out where the forest meets the meadow.
That's the title track of Ellis Paul's The Dragonfly Races. The CD recently received a Silver Honor Award from the Parents' Choice Foundation. And Ellis and guitar join us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
What a lovely sound. How did this project start? I understand there was a little songwriter envy involved, having to do with one of your young daughters listening to someone else's music.
Well, I felt like I was getting squeezed out of my own house because my adult music wasn't really appropriate all the time for the kids. You know, I'd come home and they'd be listening to stuff that it wasn't me. And I thought, well, you know, I'd really like to be able not only just to have them hear my voice, especially when I'm gone, but to have them listen to songs that are ideas that I actually wrote for them that they could be influenced by. And
how old are they?
They're 3 and 1.
Oh, see. So wonderful. And you are not home because you're a troubadour. I mean, you are on the road, on the stage a lot.
Mm-hmm. Just about every weekend.
Well, let's listen to a little of the music. You've brought your guitar, as we said. There are songs about fun. I like to swing. There's also adventure. Can we listen to a little of Because It's There? And first of all, as you get ready to play it, what inspired this song?
The thing that inspired Because It's There is George Mallory. He was a British explorer from the 1920s. He ended up passing away on Everest. He came to America to raise money for some of his expeditions, and an American reporter said, "Why are you doing it?" Because people were dying, and it was costing millions of dollars. And he said, "Because it's there."
Yeah. Let's listen.
We built a giant rocket, sent it to the moon with an astronaut, a cosmonaut, a dog, and a baboon. Tell the aliens on Jupiter that we're coming soon. We're coming just because the stars are there. Because it's there, because it's there. Because we could, because we should, because we dare. Because it's there, we'll pack some flares. We're going to the bottom, going to the top, going to the stars because they're there. Because they're there, because they're there, because they're there.
Because it's there, and it goes on, you know, we're going to go to the deepest depths of the sea because it's there. You know, I'm thinking you have been said to have, you're a direct descendant of Woody Guthrie. You also have some protest songs for kids. We'll get to those in a second. But this is an unabashed kind of joyous, celebratory thing.
Well, I wanted the songs to be about getting involved and going for it. And so there's an underlying theme in all of this, even in the stuff that's more protesty. It's really about being involved in your community and making change. It's good for you, yourself, and for your community and your family. And that goes from just jumping in the car on a road trip or getting involved in a race or marching on Washington or
right.
Whatever it is.
Well, you mentioned road trip. You appear with Flynn, who mm-hmm. also produced another CD of yours, American Jukebox Favorites. And this also seems about telling your kids what daddy does. Let's listen.
We saw the Cadillac graveyard in dinosaur land. Sang along at the Opry to a bluegrass band. The painted desert and the great sand dunes. We saw the Grand Canyon from a hot air balloon.
It really does make you want to get in the car and go, although with the price of fuel.
Yeah, it's a little tougher now.
Just listen to your CD. How much of that, though, was sort of leaving something for your kids to know what dad does?
Well, I have a legacy that I'm going to be handing them, and they're going to have to deal with it throughout their life, and there'll be periods of time where it means nothing to them, and there'll be periods of time where it means a lot to them. So I just want to make sure I'm taking care of them in the music, even when I'm away. It's strange. It's like I almost want my music to babysit them if I'm not there.
Yeah.
And that includes my adult material, because I know they're going to be teenagers. They're going to be in their 20s. They're going to be in their 30s. I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be passed on or wherever I go in the afterlife. And I still want those songs to be informing them about who I am, what I do, how I care about them, how I care about the world. And I don't know. They're like a target audience in a way for me now.
Yeah, just those two. And other parents can share. Well, there is a song that really seems to be specifically to what you're talking about. Let's listen to 9 months to Fix the World. This is when you were anticipating the birth
of my first daughter.
Of your first daughter. Let's listen.
Your mama says you're coming, and I got 9 months to fix this world. Seems like everything here's broken, and you're as precious as a pearl. I got 9 months to fix this world.
Okay, Ellis Paul, you perfectly capture, you know, an expecting parent's, you know, anxiety. But as you said, your kids are 3 and 1 now.
Yeah.
And you're, hey, the world is broken. Welcome, you know.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
A little heavy there?
Well, you know, it's really an adult song. And I put it on there, really, and it's at the very end of the record. And it's really for new parents.
Yeah.
To enjoy. But I'm finding that my daughter likes it as much as any other song. She asks for it when we're driving in the car. But I was hoping to create dialogue between parents and kids, and so it's really a family record. It's not the intention wasn't just to entertain a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old. It's really to be able to have parents handle listening to that kind of music over and over,
right,
and then discuss things that were brought up in
right.
the songs.
Let's listen to a little of Million Chameleon March. You've heard of the Million Man March. This is the chameleon equivalent. We never really hear what their grievances are, which is kind of fun because parents and kids can just assign their own. But they want change. Let's listen.
Hey, if it's broken, why not fix it? Let's fight the fight till we lick it. A bad habit we can kick it. We want change. Change, change. At the
This is the part where I think you were saying you wanted your kids to just know they can have, what, an impact? Or
yeah, and get involved in change and have fun doing it. I mean, it's even with serious causes, there's a lot of fun jumping on a bandwagon like that and making things happen.
No matter what, you leave the bandwagon up to them, it seems.
Yeah, it's their choice, but you got to get involved. You got to make the world that you want, and I'm going to tell them what they want. I want them to see the things that they want to see.
We'd like to close with the last cut on the CD. It seems like some stray sound that you've picked up with your youngest, or it would seem, huh?
It was with Ella. She's my oldest. She was 2.5 at the time.
Just magic. She sings harmony.
You know, you caught. You know, I didn't realize that, and she falls into a harmony line, and it's beautiful, and there's nothing like hearing kids sing.
Wow, it's wonderful. Ellis Paul, his new CD for kids is called The Dragonfly Races, which he also illustrated, by the way. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
You make me happy.
I'm a coyote.
You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. You want to do it one more time? You are my sunshine,
my only sunshine.
You make me happy.
And the colors are blue.
No, they're gray. When skies are gray.
No, blue.
Okay, when they're gray, blue, when whatever the skies are, you make me happy. You'll never know, dear, how much I love. Sing with me. Please don't take my sunshine away. Good job.